Hello, and welcome to the Brown Right podcast. Hey! This podcast is all about what it means and what it takes to be successful in advertising when you're from a different ethnic or socio-economic background than the majority. Before we go any further, big thanks to Smith & Weston for producing the podcast. These guys are the best. If you need music for commercials, sound engineering, radio recording, podcasts, or absolutely anything to do with sound, keep the guys in mind. Smith & Weston, they are absolute legends. Okay, we're trying something a little bit different today. As regular listeners to the podcast will know, we usually focus on guests from the creative leadership side of the advertising industry. However, to give us a different perspective, our guest today is from the commercial side of business. He started out in media, then became a journalist and reporter for Channel 9, Sky News and SBS. From 06 to 2011, he was one of the few brown faces to be seen regularly on Australian television. He then made the leap to the world of sales and commercial. Firstly at SBS, then Optus and now at Fox Sports. His family background is Indian and he's had some very interesting experiences in the world of journalism and media, which we'll get into shortly. But first, a very warm Brown Right welcome to the digital commercial manager at Fox Sports, Debs Majumdar. Debs, hello.
Hello, and thank you for that very, very lovely intro as well. I've never had everything summarised so nicely before, so thank you.
It's a pleasure. Good to have you on, mate. So can we start, as we always do, with just a little bit about your family background?
Yeah, absolutely. So Indian background, as you mentioned, moved to Australia when I was two. Fun fact, I was actually born in Sierra Leone.
Wow.
So,
India. So how did that?
Yeah. It's not India. No, my, like many Indians, living in permanently in Australia now, my dad traveled a lot for work, in the 70s and 80s. And, along the way, he was stationed in Sierra Leone, working in reinsurance, and I happened to be born along the way, and I think it was 1986. He had the choice between moving to London or Sydney, Australia, and from memory, he didn't like the cold, so Sydney won.
Yeah, and so do you consider yourselves as kind of Indian Australian? How would you sort of summarise it?
Yeah, look, I would say I am 100% Australian. I came here when I was two. I believe I sound very Australian. I dress very Australian. Everything about me is very much of that way of life. My parents, I think, consider themselves Indian Australians. You know, they've spent most of their life in Australia, but obviously, very respectful of their heritage and back home, and not to mention the fact that they have a lot of roots and friends and family back there as well.
Yeah. Okay. And your full name is actually, you're Debs, but your full name is actually Debraj, which you shorten to Debs, which is obviously quite a common thing for people to do that come to this country from various different places. But can you talk to us a little bit about the decision how it sort of went to Debs, how that happened and how you feel about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, it was one of my early jobs in the media industry, basically, but even taking a step back, a typical conversation with anyone who I'd meet through school or anyone would be, oh, hi, my name's John Smith. Who are you? I'd say, oh, I'm Debraj. Then they'd say, sorry, what was that? I'd say, Debraj. They'd say, oh, sorry, can you say it one more time? Debraj. How do you spell that? Debraj. So there was about a good 7 seconds of my life, which I always had to rinse and repeat all the time.
Frustrating.
Absolutely. So, growing up, it was a source of, I guess, frustration for me a little bit as well. And it wasn't until that first job when someone just said, oh, cool, your name's Debraj. Do you mind if I call you Debs? That's just a shorter version of it. Sounds pretty cool. And I went, do you know what? How did it take me 22 or so years to not shorten my name? And look, ever since then, it's just been Debs. I actually really like it, to be honest. Nowadays, when people say Debraj, I sometimes forget to turn around. You even said it, and my eyes kind of pricked up and went, oh, hang on, you're talking to me.
Who's this Debraj guy?
Yeah, exactly. My parents still use that name. Obviously, it's on any official certifications and that sort of thing, but you know, you ask a Jonathan if they mind being called John, I'm sure they wouldn't mind at all.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny, the Aussie thing, the Aussie colleague who sort of shortened it to Debs, it's almost like it could have been Debo. I'm surprised it wasn't Debo.
Oh, exactly. I'm glad he was a bit creative that day. he didn't go down the path of Debbie or Raj or something like that. So, look, I still, there's a lot of people who still think I'm female to this day who I haven't actually spoken to on the phone or in person, just on email. So, they still, and with a name like Debs, there's a small percentage of people out there who still think I'm female.
Yeah, interesting. And you grew up on the North Shore of Sydney, didn't you? In the 90s and the 2000s, what was that like being from an Indian background growing up? Did you experience racism? Did you fit in really well? How did you feel?
Yeah, it was an interesting time back then. So I grew up in Gordon. From in the 90s, actually, I just realised now I finished school in 2000, so purely in the 90s, I'd like to say. Much, much different. I'd like to think back, it was about 85% Anglo, 14%, I suppose, you're what people normally call Asians, so Chinese, Japanese, Koreans, and then there was the 1% others, and that was basically me. There were not many brown people.
Back, so although there were other Asians and other sort of nationalities, there weren't actually many.
No, not at all. So I was almost the minority of the minority, basically. So it was a really interesting time, actually, and I did experience my fair share of racism. I'd like to almost categorise it as two types. There was your very direct and vicious racism, but there was also your sort of casual kind of larrikin sort of racism as well, where, I would have good friends of mine, you know, poke fun at, you know, using the word curry muncher and that sort of thing. And then there was a lot of those two kind of mixes, one which was obviously very hurtful, the other one which kind of I got desensitized to over time, both of which have now nearly subsided, I'd like to say. But it was a really, really interesting time being in that sort of minority group, because my parents being of Indian heritage and living here, a lot of their friends were obviously were Indian, but they were living in other parts of Sydney, for example, Parramatta and Blacktown, where there was a higher concentration of people from subcontinental heritage. So me talking to like our family friends, we just couldn't really relate on anything because there were no other brown kids in where I was going to school. I could never relate to any of our religious holidays or anything like that, because they just would have no idea.
Yeah, and then just going back to the racism bit for a second, the direct versus the indirect, or the intentionally hurtful versus the more playful, I sort of experienced a similar sort of thing. It was almost like for me the unintentional playful stuff was even worse, because that would be from so-called friends who were like not meaning to be racist, but not realizing how hurtful that kind of language could be.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, it did bother me for a number of years, well into my teens. But as I got older, I realized that it wasn't coming from a bad place. I kind of chalked it up to, you know, the kind of larrikin way of life, whereby, you know, they would always have a joke with all their mates, and everyone's got a nickname. There's always some. You know, that kind of camaraderie, so to speak. So after a while, look, I didn't let it get to me too much. But as I got older, those that casual or indirect sort of racism, as I said, fizzled out very, very quickly.
Yeah. And what about the more vicious, intentional stuff? Because I feel as though I've talked on this podcast before a little bit about the fact that that kind of thing's not really acceptable anymore. Not in most circles, people can't and don't really come out with that kind of stuff. Although, having said that, I've seen things at sport matches, in pubs and so on, when, I don't know, in certain circumstances where stuff like that has come up, but it's more the exception rather than the rule these days, I'd say.
No, absolutely. And back then, if that, you know, the very extreme or direct or vicious racism was hurled, there definitely wasn't the reaction that there was today.
That people would jump in and sort of defend or disagree with that kind
of... Exactly. Not that I'm saying it was accepted, but there were definitely less kind of there was less of a reaction and less of a hoo-ha if and when that ever happened.
And what about today, or more recently, not just today, but more recently, do you still experience racism, either directly or indirectly?
Yeah, look, I'd say it's definitely more indirect and very infrequent and few and far between. My wife's actually Australian. She's as Australian as they come. She's blonde hair, blue-eyed, and it's funny because there have been circumstances where I have received some, you know, indirect racism and prejudice, and she's she hasn't even picked up on it at all. And it's been something which I've been quite sort of attuned to my whole life. I guess the most recent one was at a country wedding in Yass about 3-4 years ago, where there was a country guy, and I won't repeat sort of what he said, but it definitely wasn't acceptable. He had a fair few drinks, and being in Yass, I think I was also again one of the only brown guys there. I was definitely one of the only brown guys at the wedding, that's for sure.
But this was another wedding at the at the wedding.
That's correct.
That's horrible. That's
It was. And look, I remember he came up and singled me out and said what he did. And then my wife came over, you know, as you normally do. She just thought him and I were just having a casual chat. And she couldn't quite understand why I just wanted to get out of there and get away from this guy as quick as possible.
It's very strange. It's very hard to explain the feeling, how you feel when you experience something like that, isn't it? It's kind of, to someone who's not experienced it, because although when it's not physically painful, it's just sort of psychologically and emotionally really sort of belittling, I think. It's a strange, horrible experience.
It is, absolutely. And look, it's one of those feelings I can never describe, and it's one of those things which I'd never wish upon my worst enemy.
And there's something you said that really resonated with me, which is that you get to a stage, I think once you get out, even into your teens, where you just become attuned to those kind of environments or a look or body language or something that you kind of know, oh, that's going to be that way. So you try and steer clear or stay away or remove yourself from the environment.
Yeah, it's almost like you develop a bit of a sixth sense for it, and you just feel it. And, you know, naturally you don't want to confront it as well. You just you avoid it at all cost. Absolutely.
I mean, I've talked a little bit on the podcast before about the fact that, similar to you, I think, in my sort of early teens and even my later teens, I couldn't really deal with it. So I would become very quickly very confrontational. Red mist would come down, someone would say something, and there'd be arguments, shouting matches, fights, and so on. It was only much later, sort of in my mid-20s or even later 20s, that I just learned to not accept it, but to just realise that when you sort of fight confrontation with confrontation, you just end up sort of down in the same place as the person. And, you know, next thing you know, you're rolling around on the floor or punches are being thrown, and it doesn't make you look good, it doesn't make you feel better. So particularly words these days just kind of bounce off me. I think I've learned over time to just deal with them. And like you say, they're fewer and far between these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I think you ask anyone from any heritage, really, living in and growing up in a country that's obviously clearly not their own cultural heritage, they'll always have some sort of racial prejudice thrown against them. But it's all about how they kind of react to it. Like you said, you resisted and fought it. I was actually the other way. When I was younger, it really got to me. So when there were, you know, hurtful things that got thrown on me, it made me question myself as well. And I remember going home to Mum just saying, you know, why is this happening? I thought I was just the same as them. I go to school, I wear the same uniform as them, I do the same subjects as them, I race in the same races as they do, we do the exact same things, but why are they making me feel like I'm less than? Yeah. Am I less than?
Yeah, what did your mum say to that?
Oh, she's had a few choice words as well. I think she shared your view on that one.
Fight fire with fire.
Yeah, look, she said, you know, hold your ground, they don't understand. be proud of your heritage, you know, the usual usual kind of stuff. But, you know, you tell that to a seven-year-old. Yeah. Unfortunately, I'm going to listen to another seven-year-old over my mum, unfortunately. So it took a while for that to really sink in and develop a bit of a resilience against that as well.
A thicker skin, I guess. One of the things I love about living here, maybe it's because I live in Paddington, eastern suburbs, and it's just the most multicultural, multiracial sort of mixing pot you can come across. So my wife's Chinese, so my kids are mixed as well. But I think the highest concentration of ethnicity in their school in Paddington is mixed. There's every sort of kid of every kind of nationality and mix, and it's brilliant. No one would have a second thought about a brown person or Asian or whatever. It's, everyone's in there, and kids just really would never think to, you know, even think about someone's colour because they're all so different.
Oh, they're just absolutely blind to it. It's just the norm. And look, that's, you know, it's taken this long for us to be here, but that's great because now you, you know, imagine fast forward whatever it is, 20-odd years from when your kids have kids, and just imagine how diverse it is then. Yeah. There wouldn't even be, assuming there are podcasts still around in 20 years,
a discussion.
It wouldn't even be at all.
Yeah. All right, well, look, we'll come back to that theme shortly, but before we do that, I just wanted to more dig into from a different angle, into your career. So you started out in media, and then you went into journalism, and you were a reporter / producer for Channel 9, for Sky News and SBS. And in your time as a reporter, you were obviously quite prominently featured in lots of reports on TV. You must have actually been one of the few brown faces on national TV at the time. What was that like?
It was a little bit surreal, to be honest, and it didn't actually sink in. So much of my, airtime was on SBS. Mm. And it was an interesting beast there because a lot of our news packages not only were locally produced by the journos in the actual newsroom, but we also had content that was syndicated from, you know, the BBC and CNN, and they were obviously multicultural people there filing those reports as well. But it was a really, really surreal time. This was, I think, pre Waleed Ali and definitely pre-Jeremy Fernandez on ABC as well. And my parents were the biggest fans.
You're a groundbreaker.
Of all time, yeah. Every time they knew I was doing a shift, they would call all their friends and say, oh, don't forget, tune in at 6:30.
Yeah,
they would all say, don't worry, we watch the news anyway, we can't wait. So, and it was interesting as well because, a step back, is... typically, people from, I'm making a very generalisation here, but if you look at all my family friends, it's case in point. They're all from backgrounds from finance, accounting, so legal, IT, and medicine. So those very traditional kind of professions. I did not go into any of those roles. I did not go into any of those industries, so I always thought I was a bit of the black sheep. Yep. But for that black sheep to then be on TV,
The brown sheep,
the even. Brown sheep. There you go. I felt it really made my parents proud, but also like as a career achievement as well. It was fantastic to do that and break ground in that kind of space. And I'm saying breaking ground like it was amazing. It really wasn't.
But a lot of the theme of this podcast is around inspiring up and coming generations of Australian kids, or kids all over that are from different backgrounds. And there's a whole piece about if you can't see it, you can't be it. And I just think it's really important for those generations to see people that are from the same place as them, or you know, all different shades and colours of people on the national media. So I think it's quite a big deal for me that young Indian Australian kids, or young Chinese Australian kids, or whatever, would see you sort of prominently featured on the TV at the time.
Yeah, well, never thought of it that way.
Yeah, and I mean, your parents must have been so proud, you know, because although you hadn't gone the medicine route or the finance route, you'd still been, I guess, a big success in their eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. I should have thrown in engineering. Sorry, I knew there was a category I missed. Yeah, look, they loved it. And also, what I should have mentioned was I was the technology and finance reporter. So, tell you what, if you're going to give a brown reporter two categories, it's going to be those two.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Look, I owned it. I loved it. It was fantastic. And look, I actually, mum and dad always said I never talked much as a kid. I actually don't. I'm not a big or loud talker now, as you might have hopefully observed. But whenever I do say anything, it's always meaningful. So it's great that I went into that kind of role. And in fact, I didn't actually start talking till I was three, and I didn't actually have a first word either. I had a first sentence because apparently I knew how to talk. I just didn't really
save it all up until you could go the full.
Exactly.
And okay, well, just sticking with the career for a bit, Debs, because you were doing great. You know, you're on SBS, you're on national TV, but then you made the switch back to the commercial side of business. What made you take that sort of change in direction?
Yeah, look, it was two real kind of defining moments or things that always weighed on me. The first one was, I guess, reporting, which I'm hoping you can relate to, is like being a reporter or a journalist is similar to being a creative, whereby it's quite a linear thing, and to succeed you need to be bloody good at it. Like, you need to be the best. You look at all the great journos out there in Australian TV, like, you know, Anton Enos and Mark Ferguson and all of those guys. Their success came hard and fast very early on because they were just really, really fucking good at what they did. Mm. I've always thought I was good, but I wasn't great. And if I was going to do anything, I'd want it there to be somewhere. I wanted it to be something which I was great at. And if I wasn't going to be great at it, then I wanted it to be something which was a bit more, I guess, non-linear. And you know what? The commercial landscape always attracted me. My dad came from a finance and management background. So I'm sure that he was quite loosely excited when I said, look, I'm kind of still young enough now to make a career change. I want to go to the dark side of commercial. And also that going to the commercial sort of side of the business, I was cushioned a little bit, whereby I was still staying in media as well. So I saw it as a bit of a double threat, whereby I've finally now got experience from the content side of the business. Now I can learn about the commercial side, and then hopefully that'll give me a nice sort of career rounding and a really good skill set.
Yeah, it's interesting. You just reminded me, one of my mentors, sort of a famous advertising guy in London, Dave Trott, once told me, we were talking about a similar kind of thing, and he told me this anecdote that someone had come to him and said, I think it was an advertising creative, and said they wanted to kind of get out of advertising and become a piano player. They were getting into piano and they wanted to become the world's best piano player. And Dave Trott said, well, look, there's kind of two things there. You can either be the world's best, or you can be a piano player. But you know, be a piano player if you want, but you're probably not going to be the world's best piano player. Mm-hmm. But do find the thing that you are going to be the world's best at and do that.
Yeah,
which sounds like your thinking there.
I think Dave Trott was definitely onto something there. Absolutely.
Although, having said that, I think we were chatting before, and you'd mentioned that you worked in sales for a couple of years, and you actually found that quite hard. What was the deal there?
Yeah, look, and I did. It was definitely one of those career learning experiences. And look, this isn't coming back to anything racial or anything like that. So I just wanted to preface it with that. But going into sales was always, I guess, a stepping stone into that wider kind of commercial landscape, which I wanted to go into. A lot of the feedback which I was getting from hiring managers and recruiters was, look, you get the content side of the business, but I can't put you into like a straight up kind of meaty commercial role at this point. You've got no, you don't have any sort of accounting or finance degrees. You've got no idea about what's going on this side of the fence. So I said, you know what, fuck it, I'll just go into sales. It's going to be the easiest transfer I can do. So I had a tough time, mainly because I wasn't really supported from my manager at the time early in my career. He didn't really believe in training, and sales is one of those things where, you know, you train up your guys, you mentor them, you get the fundamentals right, and you can build a really, really good salesperson. I never got that. But it was also compounded by the fact that I was just a young millennial and I just wanted to get out there. And I thought I could just waltz in and get the job done. I always thought sales was a very like black and white thing at the time, but it wasn't. It was very grey. Yeah. There's a lot of negotiation. There's a lot of hard work. There's a lot of prospecting, and there's a lot of resilience involved as well. So, taking those sort of two things into mind, it was a really tough couple of years of my life. But look, like anything, I think I learnt more from those couple of years in sales than a lot of the wins in my career.
Yeah, sounds character building and building a skill base. I mean, that obviously led you to your role where you are now at Fox Sports and where you're digital commercial manager. And it sounds like your role is kind of part sales enabler, part conduit, part cat herder. Can you tell us a bit about what the role involves?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, in the digital space, things are always being disrupted, fragmented, pulled apart, broken down, however you want to look at it. So my job there is to work with our sales arm, Foxtel Media, our content side of the business, legal, acquisitions, and basically look at our whole ecosystem and come up with new strategies in terms of how we're going to identify and deliver sustainable and scalable revenue models, basically, not only through sponsorship and advertising, but through like longer, more strategic partnerships as well.
Yeah, and just going back to your days at SBS and your reporting and journalism, there's obviously a creative element there. Does the creative side of you, is it still fulfilled in the commercial role?
Yeah, I'd say it definitely is. Not to the point of a hardcore creative, but I can make a pretty mean PowerPoint, don't get me wrong. But I think it's more creative just in the way I approach things.
That's what I meant, actually, just because I think people mistake creativity for being painting pretty pictures, but just the creativity of being able to deal with people or to cut a great deal that's good for both sides.
Oh, absolutely. And in terms of bringing creativity to problem solving as well, it does matter what industry you're in, you're always going to get problems. And finding innovative new ways of thinking differently. I work very closely with our really great and talented design and UX team, and I've never had more challenging questions back from anyone in the business except from them, really. Just the way, you know, they see things differently. They're not afraid to ask some of the more challenging and poignant questions, which actually make me go, actually, wow, I didn't think of it that way. I'm going to actually give that a go.
Yeah. And then just because you just mentioned that you prefaced one of your answers with the fact that that wasn't a kind of a racial thing, the years in sales, but I did want to circle back to that sort of theme. Over the course of your career, and I'm thinking back from the start until sort of now, has your ethnicity and your cultural background ever come into play?
Yeah, it has actually. And funnily enough, you've don't know how you've done through your method or your madness there.
I did madness.
I didn't answer one of your that question earlier, and I actually said two things. One was it was more around the changing from being a reporter to the commercial side, and I said one of them was to be a reporter you had to be really, really good. Look, the other one was actually as a really ambitious young journalist, I often get advice from some of the older guys and the more seasoned ones. And I remember being catching up with one of my mentors, and I said, look, you know, I'm at the point in my career now where I'd really like to take things to the next level. I'd love to, I'd love to go on more international assignments. I'd love to do a bit of actual anchoring and, you know, some of the more hard-hitting stuff. And he basically shut me down. He did it politely and respectfully, but he basically said to me, love your energy, love your enthusiasm, but you know what, if you really do want to carve out this career in broadcast journalism, unfortunately, just the way the industry is at the moment in Australia, is the only places you could really go is ABC and SBS. Unless, of course, you wanted to go overseas, then that's great. But you'd have a lot of trouble at 7, 9 and 10 and the commercial networks. And that's when it really hit hard. I could either stay and fight and try and be one of those trailblazers, or I could jump ship and try something else.
And just on that anecdote, just that advice that you were given, do you think that mentor was being constructive and helpful and realistic to a point, or was there a bit of sort of cynicism in there and a bit of, not racism, but just a bit of blocking just because of who you are?
Yeah, look, I think like my friends growing up, this was one of those things that fell into the... he didn't mean any harm by what he said. He was an older, more prominent journo. So, yeah, there could have been some cynicism in there. But I, at the time, took it as more of this guy's been around for a while.
He knows what he's talking about.
He knows what he's talking about. And what you don't often find in media is he's actually a realist. So I took his advice to heart. I knew he wasn't trying to dissuade me from anything. He had nothing to really gain by giving me that sort of advice. He had nothing to lose either.
Yeah. It's interesting because you mentioned, I think, before, there's people like Waleed Ali and Jeremy Fernandez now are pretty much household names in the country. How does that make you feel now? Is there a pride that you kind of came first before them? Is there a kind of slight bitterness that could have been you kind of building that career?
There's no bitterness whatsoever. And I'm sure these guys were punching well above their weight when I was doing.
Pretty awesome.
They are. And look, what's really cool about these two is that they're not just token brown guys fronting the news. Like, Waleed's actually a really cool guy. He's a presenter. He's a lawyer. He's a university lecturer. He plays the guitar. That's amazing. I remember asking Mum if I could learn to play the guitar when I was in year five, and she said, no, concentrate on your maths. So that was amazing. That was interesting. look, Jeremy Fernandez, he was now whenever I... My in-laws actually religiously watch ABC News, and they... absolutely love him. I think he does a fantastic job. So much so that when I was just transitioning out of my journalism days, I had some of their family friends call them and say, "Wow, your son-in-law's doing a great job on the ABC," and they would say, "Well, we've never seen him before, but that's not exactly our son-in-law. Looks a little bit similar, but no, not him." Yeah. But hey, I was glad to be mistaken for him.
Yeah, I mean, my take on it is both of those guys are just amazingly, amazingly talented. And it's like, I think like you said, Debs, they're clearly not there to make up the numbers or to tick box on a quota thing or whatever. They are there clearly on talent. It just makes me proud, actually, to see those guys doing so well.
Yeah, absolutely. No, they do a fantastic job, and Waleed especially, because he's broken ground in on those commercial networks. He's on Channel 10, on The Project. He's doing great.
Yeah. And then sort of shifting the conversation over to your current role and your current sector over in media, what's the cultural makeup of the media sector like? Is it quite a mixed and diverse environment?
Yeah, look, I'd say it's absolutely diverse. My job awards me the opportunity to be on the road quite a lot and meet a lot of our clients, our partners, our agencies, and everyone. And there's a lot of English people out. There's a lot of English accents.
Yeah, there is a lot of us over here. Yeah,
but there are. They're very culturally diverse, absolutely. Not a whole lot of, I guess, people from the subcontinental heritage, but there's a lot of Europeans, a lot of, I'd like to say, Asians in terms of, your Koreans, Japanese, and that sort of thing. But they're all first or second generation Aussies and look like your kids in Paddo. No one sees sort of ethnicity or anything like that. Everyone is absolutely judged on and measured by what they deliver and what they bring to the table.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I love the fact that younger generation, my kids and probably your kids, just don't see, it's not even a conversation. So I'm slightly torn because here I am on a podcast called Brown Right and I'm trying to celebrate the achievements of brown people that are doing amazing things. But like you said before, hopefully in years to come, it won't be a conversation that's necessary. We'll have moved on from there. It just won't, race, colour, all of those things just won't be a big deal.
No, not at all. And look, I'm sure this podcast will evolve to, talking to industry leaders and that sort of thing, irrespective of, where they're from. Mm. It's a very small part of, obviously makes up who they are today, but doesn't define who they are or how they go about things.
Yeah. And a few guests on the podcast, I mean, including myself, have had sometimes funny, hilarious, but sometimes not so funny experiences of being mistaken for someone else due to their ethnicity or the colour of their skin. Has that ever happened to you, things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, being mistaken for Jeremy Fernandez, that was a good one.
Yeah, that
fell into the good category, absolutely.
Take that one.
But no, there have been some interesting ones, actually. So part of my role, which I've been lucky enough to do, is I get invited to speak at a couple of conferences around the country, and it was December last year, and I was giving a keynote in Queensland at the Star or Star City, and it was going to be in a room full of about maybe 500-600 people. And I remember flying in that morning, and I wasn't due to go up on stage till sort of 10:30, 11, and I remember getting to the hotel early, and I thought, you know what, I'm just going to go check out the function area anyway, because I want to see what the heck I've signed up for here.
Yep.
None of the delegates had pulled into the room or anything like that, and I remember walking in, and all of the stagehands and everything were all setting everything up, the chairs were all set up. I was quietly shitting my pants at the size of how many chairs there were, and all of a sudden, some of the AV guys started coming over to me. And this is, all I had was my laptop bag. I was in, like, ripped jeans and a polo because I just flew in that day. And I left my suitcase at the check-in. And the guys started having a conversation with me. And I thought, oh, these guys must have seen me on the,
on the
box. And they're just saying g'day and that sort of thing. And they were just sort of making small talk. Then they started talking about, like, what they were doing. I was like, you guys, that's great. I understand what you're here for. You're obviously in black T-shirts and you've got headsets and you're moving heavy machinery. And it only occurred to me after a couple of minutes that they thought I was there to fix the overhead projector, basically. Mm. So they thought I was one of the IT guys who'd come in. And I ended up correcting them, and they just felt, rightly so, a little bit embarrassed.
Yeah, mortified,
But I didn't take any offence to it whatsoever. But the fact that, I walked in and they immediately thought, oh, here's the guy to fix the projector. Because, look, a lot of guys in IT are typically from subcontinental heritage, and they just thought I was there to help them out with some technical issues.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, Debs, I've experienced things like that myself. Various guests on the podcast have experienced similar kind of things. Where I'm at with it is that I've never been pissed off with the people that have made that mistake. It's more, because I always think it's less a reflection on them and more a reflection on where society's at the time. You know, mm-hmm. It was a genuine mistake, but people just think those things because of the zeitgeist, and there's not enough brown faces doing other things other than those expected things. So
yeah, absolutely. And look, it comes back to and these guys were they were apologetic once they found out. And again, it wasn't coming from a bad place. And I could have anyone in that situation could have compounded it worse by making a scene of it, but, you know, they didn't mean any harm by it, and I wasn't offended whatsoever. Mm. I actually thought, I was pretty flattered they thought I could fix a projector. I was just there to give a keynote.
Yeah. The Jeremy Fernandez thing was better, though, I think. I always fancy myself as having a bit of the Adam Goods about me, but no one agrees. I see pictures of it. I'm like, oh, come on, I look like Goodsy, and my missus is like, no, you don't. No, fair enough.
I'm a few more gym sessions away from getting mixed up for Idris Elba, so I'm trying to work on that one. So.
Yeah. Going back to your career then, across, again, the reporting, the journalism, the broadcast journalism, over to the media and the commercial side of things, have you ever seen, or do you see even now, your ethnicity as a barrier to your success, or do you see it as an advantage even?
Look, I'd say it's neither. Right now, given the climate that we live in, and especially just corporate Australia media, Australia, actually any kind of Australian workplace now, you're getting measured and judged more on what you bring to the table and the results, irrespective of your ethnicity.
Yeah.
And we live in a very kind of hyper-sensitive and hyper-aware time where no one would ever kind of make that judgment or remark in with respect to that. So now I don't ever see it as either a success or a barrier. Where it does play on my mind a little bit is back when I was job hunting, I always thought, oh, well, my surname's Majumdar. Would that maybe put me in a less favourable category than, you know, someone called Smith? But I guess there's no way to ever prove that. Oh, but that was just something.
I think I've seen some research, a young team, young creative team showed me some research recently where more Western Caucasian sounding names were seen to be more successful in as job candidates than names from the subcontinent or Asian names or whatever. Yeah, which is sad. It's sad, isn't it?
It is, and that's the only time, I suppose, where I thought it may have weighed in because, again, arguably wasn't being measured on my on what I'd bring to the table.
That's even before you've got to the table.
Exactly.
That's something there's nothing you can do about.
Totally.
I mean, in my world, in the advertising world, I've spoken a lot about the fact that I think the advertising industry is way too kind of one-dimensional. It's very male and Caucasian, and things are changing for the better and quite quickly. I'd like it to move a bit more quickly in terms of diversity. But I would say 9 out of 10, if not 10 out of 10, creative directors in advertising couldn't give a fuck whether a team is male, female, black, white, yellow, whatever. Can you bring the goods? Can you deliver great ideas and great thinking, or can't you? Because it doesn't really matter to me, you know, who's doing the thinking, just can you deliver something really fresh and interesting?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it's all about what you bring to the table and the results you can achieve as well.
Mm. I mean, how does that make you feel about, because I've had a lot of debates with people about quotas as well. I think in general I'm against quotas. I just hate the idea of people being given roles in any sector, really, just on the basis of we needed to have 25% of whatever group. It just seems a little bit like that could backfire because, number one, if that was me, I'd feel terrible knowing that I'd got a role off the back of something that was not, you know, not one of my skills, just who I am. And number two, I think people could be put into roles that they're not as well qualified for as, you know, a Caucasian person or a male person or whatever, and then they don't perform so well and the whole thing backfires.
Yeah, look, 100%. The quotas were always, I guess, some sort of political knee-jerk kind of thing which had come about. I definitely don't believe in them. And I think over time, you know, you've got when you've got the right executive or leadership team in place, that shouldn't really matter at all. You know, over time, they'll always hire based on people's merits and the skill sets in which they bring, irrespective of if they're male, female, Asian, Korean, Japanese. Yeah. I've run out of other ethnicities to say, you know, Afghan, wherever.
And then putting it into your specific context in the world of sport and the media industry and those that the context that you move in, what do you think needs to happen? I mean, if anything, just to make that whole sector more representative of the whole nation? Are there changes that should be put in place?
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting one. I think sport lends itself naturally just to a multicultural kind of lens in itself. You know, you've got a lot of great Indigenous players in every single code now, in AFL, in definitely in the NRL. You know, I think you looked at the Rugby World Cup a couple of weeks ago. You saw England and, you know, there weren't a whole lot of Caucasian faces in that team.
Very mixed.
The Australian as well. There's a lot of Islanders in there as well. Sport's one of those things where, you know, it's just so lively. It's so passionate. It's almost, I find sometimes, at least when you're on the sidelines, ethnicity doesn't matter. It's just about the passion and, again, the results in which people can bring on the field, honest.
That is, I would agree, and that is, as you say, you look at the World Cup, you look at the England team, the Australia team, the South Africa team particularly, with a really integrated team. And in general, as a rule, sports fans don't really see the colours. Can you score a goal? Can you score? You know, can you get a try? All of those things, I think, in general, which is very different from 30, 40 years ago in the Premier League football, for example, there was massive racism issues. Black players were not accepted to start with. It took a long time, and there's still abuse of black players today in football. But I just wanted to bring it to a more Australian context, because although we say all of those good things, you look at something like the Adam Goods recent documentary, the Final Quarter, I think it was called. It's just heartbreaking that a guy who has achieved amazing things, who's an idol to so many people, who's inspired so many fans, kids, all of those, done Australian of the Year, all of those things, could be hounded out of his career, the last bits of his career, and sort of end up feeling very bitter about the sport because of the way that he was received. Because he, I don't know, because he kind of had the balls or the integrity to bring up issues that, I don't know, maybe people don't want to talk about. What was your take on that whole thing?
Look, I thought it was really disgusting the way that went down. Look, Goodsies he's one of the once-in-a-generation player. He was fantastic. And for him to have those feelings, it was really hard. I remember seeing that, and I shared a lot in some of his feelings on that as well.
Sad. Yeah, I mean, my take on it was, the reason I thought it was interesting, but sad, tragic even more than sad, was that, as we were saying before, the zeitgeist, the world has kind of moved on from racism, outright racism. It's not really accepted. People don't, you know, if people use, you know, derogatory terms or whatever, people would be shouted down for doing that. But around the Goodsy thing towards the end of his career, this sort of weird mob mentality arose where people thought it was okay to be booing him, sort of under cover of the fact that, I don't know, he wasn't a good player, or he was looking for special treatment. But for me, it had a very kind of clear hard edge of racism.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what, he did such amazing work for the Swans. Like, he was just such an amazing player, and for that to be, for racial stuff to discredit that, was just absolutely heartbreaking.
It's a shame. Just coming back to you, moving from Goodsy back to you, a lot of the guests on the show have got a really quite a complicated relationship with their heritage. My heritage is quite mixed, so I have got a really strange, kind of very proud, but mixed feelings, I think, is the best way to describe it. Almost a love-hate thing a lot of people have. How do you feel about your heritage? Because, you know, obviously you've mentioned your wife is Aussie. She's Aussie. You mentioned to me before that she actually knows more about your culture than you do.
She does, actually, and she can actually eat spicier food than I can as well. It's quite embarrassing.
Yeah, and I take it you're proud of your Indian heritage, but you just see yourself as Aussie, as Australian.
Yeah, I do. And it's not to discredit my Indian heritage, but I guess it's just more. And look, this could have been a byproduct of just the racism that I felt growing up. But I definitely associate myself and consider myself more Australian than Indian, absolutely. And there were points in my life where I would actively move away from, I guess, other Indian people. I would go as far as, you know, making sure I don't dress anything like an Indian person either, you know, and distance myself from the culture, almost sort of too far, until I met my wife, who taught me to embrace it just a little bit more.
Yeah, it's interesting that one of our previous guests, Priya Patel.
Yeah, I know her
from DDB.
Well,
yeah.
Sorry, I don't know.
I know you're a bit of a fan. Yeah, she talked about a similar thing where there was another Indian girl in her, I think it was a school or a uni, and she, I think, almost subconsciously went out of her way to not be like her and not sort of hang out with her.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you know what? I had the exact same thing in, funny you say that, in year six, there was a guy called Sarav who started at school, and he was the only other brown guy who started my entire 5 years at primary school. And I remember, you know, I don't know if you put this in the direct or indirect racism bucket, but when he started, there were a lot of people who came up to me and were like, oh, do you know Sarav? Is he your brother? Are you going to play with him at lunchtime? Yeah. You know, just those sort of things. Yeah. And I made a conscious effort not to be friends with Sarav at all, even to the point where if we were, you know, lining up for the handball courts or sitting down, I'd make an effort to purposely sit away from him.
Yeah, yeah. Sad, isn't it? I know. It's sad in reflection. I'd put that in the direct.
Yeah, I think so. And look, I'm partly to blame. I shouldn't have acted like that as well. Mm. He was a good guy. I've got nothing against
the rap. It's a complicated thing, isn't it? It's all wrapped up in the experiences you go through, the names you get called, the way you see yourself, all of those things. It's almost a subconscious thing, I think, to distance yourself. Hey, what we normally do? Well, because most of the guests are usually on the podcast, usually creative directors, we usually talk about a favourite piece of work that is normally like an ad or an activation or some kind of work that they've done. Mm-hmm. You're obviously more in the commercial world, but do you? We've talked a bit about how the commercial world is very, I think, is very creative.
Yeah.
Someone like Richard Branson is far more creative than most so-called creatives in ad agencies.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favourite piece of work you've done, or perhaps a sort of a favourite piece of creative work you've seen out in the world?
Yeah, look, I see them all the time. Being on the commercial side of the business, and Foxtel Media, our sales arm, get to help work with a lot of cool brands and produce some of this stuff as well. I'm going to plug the company I do work for.
Get a quick plug in.
Look, earlier this year, I'm not sure if you saw, it was in the lead up to the Super Bowl, and it was for KO Sports, our streaming sports property. And, we had Australia's first ever NFL game on a barge on Sydney Harbour. And it was a great bit of content that, it had NFL star Michael Dixon and Josh Jenkins as well. And these guys were just playing footy on the barge with the backdrop of Sydney Harbour, full KO branding and everything. And that bit of content got seeded out all through the usual kind of channels. But then what was really, really cool about that was, one, it was just a logistical kind of nightmare, which was pulled off so successfully. And secondly, it got a run at the Super Bowl feed as well. And, having the American commentators say something like, these are Aussies, playing football and Sydney Harbour. And, it was a nice little vignette. I think it was a simple idea, but with a lot of complications, that was executed very, very well.
Yeah, I can imagine the logistics behind that.
Yes.
I mean, you mentioned KO, which is obviously one of your, something that you work with. I think even the NFL on the barge thing that you mentioned, yeah, it's creative. But I would say the idea of KO itself, the idea of a sports streaming, kind of a Netflix for sport, is is one of the most creative ideas that's that we've seen in this country for years.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, there's creativity and there's creativity for the sake of creativity, but there's creativity when you're trying to respond and deliver a product for your customers, and that's really what we did. We tick those two goals really, really well in terms of delivering sport at a much frictionless experience at a really good price point as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's a famous quote from Edward de Bono, who said, many people calling themselves creatives are mere stylists. Real creativity is something like KO, sort of changing a market, something that's very different, that's not been seen before.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
And then just staying with the commercial, well, maybe sort of switching gears a little bit, but we mentioned Priya Patel, who was a recent guest on, and I know you're a fan. What is it about Priya that you see as a role model or something to look up to?
Yeah, look, I remember listening to a podcast with you, and that was probably the third or fourth one of Brown Riot that I listened to. But that was the one which I reckon I listened to about four or five times, because look, with podcasts, they run for however long, 30, 40 minutes. Hopefully you don't cut me down too much, mate. But I remember...
Just cut me, not you.
Not at all, mate. I remember listening to it when I was in the car, listening to it when I was at the gym, at work, on a walk. And I just remember always listening to it again, and then picking up bits which maybe I tuned out of, or I just didn't grasp entirely, just some of the insights, which I just absolutely loved. And one thing which there were three things actually, which was quite funny. Which we had some really funny similarities. Was she was almost everything that I kind of wasn't in my parents' eyes. Sometimes she went to Oxford Uni. That's pretty amazing. My parents always wanted me to go there. My parents always wanted me to be a CEO or a managing director of a company. Well, she runs DDB. And also, look, to your point as well, she had that situation in school or uni where there was that other girl called Priya who she avoided like the plague.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. I think a fourth one that I'd add to while we're heaping a bit of praise on Priya is the fact that she's achieved all of those things and she's done all of that stuff and she's just amazingly down to earth. She hasn't got tickets on herself. She's not a big head. She's not kind of a raging ego. She's just a really lovely down to earth person.
Yeah, and look, one thing I really did admire about that particular podcast, and I don't know if she called it out specifically, but it was what I really took away from it, was she really embraced a lot of the diversity that's happened throughout her life, and she's used that and molded that to help shape her career. And I think, you know, working somewhere at DDB with all the projects, and not to mention the personalities and the stakeholders, I guess embracing all of that diversity and turning it into creativity as well, I think is just such an amazing gift, which you can't quantify or ever measure as well.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, true. Yeah, she's pretty awesome. All right, Debs, well, look, time to finish up now. But as we do with all the guests, is there a thought or an insight or an anecdote or a quote or some sort of provocation that you could leave us with? A little bit of advice, maybe.
Advice. Yeah, look, I always think some of my advice is either really good or really bad. So take with it what you can. Look, I've wanted to kind of talk about three quick things. One is I've recently been doing a bit of exec coaching with a guy called Alex Wickett from Adept Leadership, great guy. And he really taught me to think about what's my purpose in life and what are the principles that I'm going to live by. And once I've got those things really, really clear, everything else kind of in life will really be a lot easier and make sense. I'm not fully there yet, but it's definitely helped change the way I go about things. If things don't line up to my purpose in life, then it really opens my eyes in terms of questioning why am I actually doing it. Similarly, if there are things which don't apply or don't align with the principles I lead my life in, should I really be a part of it? And they're sort of things, even though I haven't fully mastered it or got a complete grasp of it yet, it's always stuff which I tell the guys in my team, you know, work on your purpose, work on your why. And then, you know, because everyone loves quotes, you did mention I've got two ones which I always lead kind of my life by, and I've got one pinned in my Evernote app. Was one by Steve Jobs, which was be a yardstick of quality. Some people aren't used to an environment where excellence is expected. And that's just kind of how I always like to lead everything I do, be it at the gym, with friends, at work. Just be good at what you do. You don't have to be the best, but just really, really try and be the absolute best you can actually be. And try and surprise people by how good you can be as well.
Yeah, yeah. And we were talking about creativity before. It doesn't get more creative than Steve Jobs.
Yes, absolutely. Who's also a business visionary as well. So a guy who gets both left and right side of the brain. And the last one was a quote by Alan Armstrong, which was a sport-related one, but is applicable everywhere. And this one was just because it gets me in the right mindset, which is my kind of hobby and something which I'm training for at the moment. Next year, I want to do my first bodybuilding show. And he said, champions don't become champions when they win the event, but in the hours and weeks and months and the years that they spend preparing for it. So, you know, it's all in the prep, it's all in the training, it's all in the mindset, it's all in the you know, you play a game, whatever it is, say it's footy, you play a game for 90 minutes, but think about all the hours and the weeks and the days and the months that you're training for it. You know, fitness and bodybuilding is pretty much similar to that. You're on stage for, I don't know, maybe 90 seconds, but you are training for, well, I've been training for this for 8 months, and it'll be another three more before I can actually step on stage.
Yeah. Thanks, mate. Well, good luck with that.
Thank you very much, Ant.
Thank you for, you've been our first non-creative director on Brown Riot, so breaking ground again.
There you go.
It's been good to have you on.
And you put me after Priya, so, oh no.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks so much, Ant. Appreciate it.